Regional Committee of the St. Paul City Council to order. Good morning to my colleagues and good morning to folks that are here to listen. We have a presentation this morning from Chris Clark from Xcel Energy, president of the Minnesota, South Dakota, and North Dakota. I was wondering how many states you're the president of. It's kind of exciting to have you in the room. But we had a conversation in the midst of our Climate Action Resiliency Plan conversation, and rather than try to mingle this conversation into the public hearing or on top of that, I think the idea was to invite you in separately to talk about, as I said to my colleagues yesterday, the challenges and opportunities and innovations and partnerships, and just to get a lay of the land as we continue to move forward using our Climate Action Resiliency Plan as a lens around which we make decisions. And I think understanding Xcel is a leader in this industry and has been a partner to the city and is also a big old regulated utility that has its own challenges, it would be helpful to have this information. So we are grateful to have you here today. Usually when we do presentations, we interrupt, we ask
Sounds
questions,
good.
But that means by the time we get to the end, most of the things are covered. So I think that we'll stick with that. And if it's something that you're planning to get to, feel free to let us know that you'll get to it. And otherwise, welcome. It's wonderful to have you here, Mr. Clark.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here. Thank you all for your service. I know it's hard work, and I appreciate the work you do. We like to say that as a company headquartered in the Twin Cities, we've been in our communities for over 100 years, and we'd like to be here for the next 100 years. And part of how we make sure that we do that is really engaging with our public officials and key stakeholders. And so one of the things that we've seen over the last several years is much greater interest in our communities, in our customers, and in our corporate customers in how we're going to achieve sustainability goals. So it's been an exciting time in the industry. What I'll try to do today is just cover a lot of the things that we are working on, highlight some of the areas where we think we were achieving that national leadership, highlight some of the areas where we've sparked a little controversy, because no doubt some of that will find its way to you as elected officials, and want to share with you how we're approaching that. And then also want to highlight some of the things that we are doing in the community and our commitment to engaging in the community, and of course our openness to ideas about how we can do better on that front or opportunities that you see for us. So I'll just start with a quick overview. As you said, I'm the president of our Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota operating company. We're actually the largest utility in each of those states. We serve population centers in North Dakota and South Dakota, so that's what gets us the victory there. We obviously have the big metro area here, but out to greater Minnesota as well. And we actually like the opportunity to serve both states that are diverse politically, diverse geographically, and diverse in the business focus. And it's helpful to us as a company. So, of course, in addition to those states, we serve over in Wisconsin, from La Crosse up to Eau Claire, and then north up to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. We operate that five-state Upper Midwest system as one system, so the decisions we make in our resource planning really impact all five of the states where we have service territory. We're also the utility out in Denver, Colorado, and then serve along the Front Range in Colorado. It's our second biggest presence to the Minnesota service territory. And then Amarillo, Texas, over to Roswell, New Mexico. So that's all the UFO jokes in Roswell. But it's also a place where the two states have a very different approach to the future, but they're both actually experiencing significant growth with oil and gas exploration. So it's a very different take on how we interact with industries that are tied to the carbon emissions and the climate change issue.
On this map, then, the gray is all electricity customers. And
so the red is our service territories, and the darker gray are the states that we serve, and then just a set against the U.S. map there. So we are actually one of the biggest investor-owned utilities. Like a lot of investor-owned utilities, we tend to concentrate in the population areas, and then when you get outside of a community, you interact with the co-ops, like GRE has, Dakota Electric, et cetera. We are a national and have been a national wind leader. Because of Minnesota's policies, we've been a national leader on energy efficiency. We are leading the way in the industry on carbon reductions. We did announce about a year and a few months ago the plan to get to 80% carbon reduction by 2030 and then an aspiration to hit 100% carbon-free energy by 2050. We're the first utility to do that. We've had a bunch of other utilities follow us. Our CEO is actually rising to lead the investor-owned utility group, Edison Electric Institute, and has actually put a lot of pressure on our friends at other companies to join us in what we're doing and actually try to change the dialogue to not whether we can do this, but how we can do this. So that's a little overview. In serving Minnesota, just some statistics of the number of customers we serve. And then, of course, we're proud of our reliability. People notice when the lights are out, but for the most part, we keep the lights on. Our more sensitive customers notice even voltage changes. So a lot of focus on making sure that we're delivering quality product and keeping the lights on. And, of course, when the lights do go out, we interact with community officials because people are calling you, people are calling the city, and we want to make sure that we're keeping essential services going. These are our overall corporate priorities. They've been our priorities for several years, and they actually guide how we make our decisions at the company. We're focused on leading the clean energy transition, and that's reflected in our national leadership, but also the announcement of closing all of our coal by 2030 and the plan we filed with the commission to hit the 80% carbon reduction. It's also the embracing of innovation, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through this. Enhancing the customer experience is something I'm sure you're all dealing with, too. More and more people like to be able to access their services through their phone, through their computer, and so we're trying to make sure that we're delivering on that front. When we do have outages, we have an app that customers can track the expected time. That was actually a culture change for us with our employees because the crews actually wanted to go out, restore, and they were used to then doing all the paperwork when they got back to the office, or paperwork being putting stuff into their tablet. We actually had to switch their thinking to, as you finish a job, you need to enter it into the system so that customers know you're moving on to the next. And their initial reaction was, you're going to slow me down. I could get somebody's lights on faster if I just keep going. But once we actually were able to show them the statistics of the certainty of when the lights come back on is actually more important to customers than you getting there 15 minutes or a half an hour earlier. And so it was a real learning experience for us, and I think there's a lot of that that happens as we adopt technology in our business and try to do better. And, of course, the Apples and Amazons keep raising the bar on us, so we're all trying to do what we can. And then finally, keeping bills low is both on the affordability front, but also on the competitiveness for the companies that employ our residents and provide jobs and run the economy. So we want to make sure that we are keeping bills affordable and keeping our rates competitive. At the same time, we need to balance that with making the investments that are necessary for reliability and also embracing the transition that we're on. So we don't view keeping bills low as a reason not to make the transition. It's just a guiding principle that we need to make the transition as cost effectively as we can. And we've seen other parts of the country struggle when they don't make those investments.
And before you move to the next slide, Ms. Naker has a question, and then I have a question.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Thank you. Chris, you may be getting to this later, but I'm just curious, when you say 100% carbon reduction, does carbon mean just coal? Is it also natural gas? What's included in that?
So our announcement was focused on the electric system. The plan we filed with the Utilities Commission will get us 80% carbon reduction from 05 levels by 2030, and that really is accomplished through the closure of the coal units as the main contributor to the carbon on the electric system. It's also addition of wind and solar to the system and continuing the operation of our nuclear units through their life. The nuclear units actually make it possible to get there fairly easily for us to the 80%. Whether we continue operating those is actually another question that'll come in front of the commission and as part of that 2050 discussion. The 100% is an aspiration to get to 100% carbon-free energy. And it's very intentional that we didn't go 100% renewable or wind and solar because the work we've done suggests that you can get to about 70 or 80% renewable, but beyond that, it gets really difficult and really expensive to do the rest with renewable. So we embrace the carbon-free, but it's also an official embracement of innovation that will happen in the 20s and 30s. We'll figure out how to do things that we don't know how to do today, and that will open up new possibilities. On the natural gas system, we're spending more time now trying to figure out how we get to reducing carbon in home heating and other places where people use natural gas. We're at the very beginning stages of that work as an industry. I would say we're probably a little beyond, but still at the beginning of trying to chase methane upstream with pipelines and other suppliers. And you get a lot of bang for the buck with chasing the methane. But, you know, there's a lot of R&D coming into heat pumps and ways to try to electrify home heating. But it is Minnesota, and the technologies are just getting there, I would say. So we have a lot of work to do on that front. And there's more to come, I guess, is all I can promise there. It's not easy, but we're committed to figuring that out, too, but very much at the beginning on that.
Thanks.
My question is, when I see the header, Xcel Energy Priorities, I know this is just some of Xcel Energy's priorities, and when I think back to my experience working with regulated utilities, one of the biggest priorities that came up again and again is the responsibility to the shareholders.
Right.
And I'm wondering, how does that knit into keeping the bills low and leading the clean energy transition? Because I know that is a huge priority for...
Sure. So, yeah, some of the things that I think fall out of this and that are inherent in an investor-owned utility are we want to deliver positive returns and growth for our investors, and we want to deliver that affordability and reliability for our customers. We want to have a positive relationship with our utilities commission, legislature, governor, and cities, key stakeholders. So balancing all those is part of what we do. For investors, they actually are embracing our leadership on the clean energy transition. We're getting recognized in the industry for what we're doing. It has provided us opportunities to both own some of the new resources, so we're owning some of the wind projects, and not all of them, but a good chunk of them in that last round. And we see other opportunities to own resources, so that provides us some growth opportunity. We've also had a lot of neighbors talking to us about how we've done this. What I see with a lot of utilities is they can figure out how to close their older coal plants like we did with High Bridge Riverside. And they're doing that now. We did that, obviously, back in the earlier 2000s. So when we start talking about eliminating all the coal plants on our system, we've had questions from other utilities of really how are you going to do that. And it comes down to the engineers concerned about reliability who get very worried about taking that last baseload in their view of the system resource away. How can you really count on that? And we've actually done the work to be able to confidently say we can pull all those units off. We do think we need some natural gas for the reliability and resiliency, and there's some controversy around that. But that kind of leadership has actually resonated well with investors, and we've been able to show that we can do the transition affordably for our customers. Now, I was actually just with a customer yesterday afternoon, and they were complimenting us on, you've added a ton of your renewables to your system, but that hasn't driven your rates through the ceiling, and that was their worry as an energy-intensive customer. So those are how we try to balance it. And then the other thing I would say is it really does require engaging with policymakers. For us, the commission is obviously that regulator. And so when we work with them on pilots and opportunities, we see upside for us with investors, but also we have to deliver on the transition. One of the big opportunities I see right now that investors will like is with electric transportation. So bringing clean energy to transportation is a great opportunity for us. Ironically, our sales continue to go down because of our great conservation programs here. So we're not a regular business. We're actually paying our customers to use less energy. So it makes the business equation more challenging. The electric use will actually bring it back up to hopefully flat, but still declining, because we'll still be chasing energy efficiency with our customers, but we'll be eliminating carbon in the transportation sector and actually saving customers money. But the other part of it, and this is where the investor pressure and the policy pressure intersect. The investor pressure would tell us replace everybody's car with an electric car. That's good growth for the revenue side of the business. But what our communities tell us, our policy leaders tell us, is as we make the shift to cleaner energy and transportation, we need to be embracing transit. We need to think, we actually need to be rethinking transportation, making sure that we have livable communities, that our roads are safe for pedestrians and bicyclists, and that we're actually thinking from a much bigger picture. So we actually have to remind our folks as we're doing this, it's not just about two electric cars in every garage. It's can we go to one electric car in every garage and then have an opportunity to work with our communities on different transit solutions. So that's an example of where we try to bridge those investor and policy issues. So I mentioned the goal. I'll kind of move through some of these slides quickly to try to be respectful of time, but please keep interrupting with questions or that's not even interrupting. It's a conversation, so sorry. Our goals do align us with the Paris targets. This is a question we got asked by a lot of communities working on sustainability and also by a lot of customers focused on sustainability. Where were we with those? And so we're happy that we can do that. The aspiration to 100% carbon free is actually an opportunity for us to discuss how we think that other technologies are going to need to play in. And the other discussion we like to have is once you hit 80% carbon reduction, you really do need to be thinking cross-sector, because as a society, there may be more opportunities to get more bang for the buck chasing methane upstream, clean energy to transportation, and actually starting to work with other sectors, agricultural and industrial, on what other solutions are for them. One of the things we're doing with our nuclear units is trying to figure out as we ramp our nuclear units, which is not what they traditionally did. They used to run flat out. We're now ramping our nuclear units in the MISO market so that as we have more renewables on the system, we can pull our nuclear units down. That is carbon-free energy, so if we can bring those units back up to full and make hydrogen with it, you're now making carbon-free hydrogen energy. So we have a DOE grant to start doing that. And hydrogen is actually one of the fuels that may give us some answers on the natural gas side. Yes?
And I'm sorry about this because it's highly technical for me and my mind goes, it doesn't work. Twice you've used the expression chasing methane upstream, and
sure.
I just wondered if you could explain that.
Oh, sure. So the methane emissions have a much more serious carbon or climate impact than even carbon. Mm-hmm. So, and the concern is that with the gathering of natural gas and then the transport of it to us, so the gathering is done by independent gatherers, transported through interstate pipelines traditionally to a local distribution company, which distributes it to customers. We're the local distribution company. And so in the past, the thinking was the gatherers and the pipeline company, those are separate businesses. They supply us. We simply take the product from them. Now the conversation is coming to us. What do we do with the natural gas system? One of the first things we're doing is pushing our suppliers, clean up your release of methane in the process you use.
Is that in fracking that creates the methane?
What we're focused on is more in the transport through the natural, you know, just a small leak in the pipeline or inefficiency in the gathering process and the moving it to the pipeline create opportunities for methane to release. And you do get some as you gather from the fracking. I mean, they obviously try not to, but that's the pressure we're trying to put on suppliers.
Ms. Anker.
Thank you. Am I reading this graph right, that you're aiming for 100% reduction, which is really ambitious, but that even if you fell sort of short of that, you might still be within that range that is estimated to bring us below 2 degrees Celsius in warming?
Yes.
And that's according to the Paris Accord, or where does that, the graph come from?
Yeah, the 2 degree, I think, and the graph, the dark area represents where we need to be to get into the Paris, or stay in the goals under the Paris Accord. And obviously there's a desire to get, now I think there's a discussion around 1.5, and we've modeled our plan against others. We actually want to make sure that as a leader we're actually pushing to the leading edge of that.
Right. How do you feel about your thank you. How do you feel about your 100% carbon free goal, like that timeline being 2050?
So I think for me what keeps the aspiration and the goal, the two pieces of it, hitting 80% by 2030 requires work, but we know how to do it. And I think for us on that goal, what we're trying to do is look for opportunities to actually accelerate. So we filed with the Minnesota Commission in July the plan to close our coal plants by 2030. We filed in December a plan to actually start operating our coal plants differently so that during the 20s we can actually get more carbon reduction. So that's on the goal to get to 80. On the aspiration to get to 100%, really what we were, what happened when we made the announcement was actually a culture change internally, embracing the innovation that's going to be necessary, and actually a change in the approach to people asking the question of, will we ever shut down Sherco 3, which is our largest coal unit, and was that one that our engineers were kind of clinging to of, we'll just keep this. I like to say that last coal unit, people want to build a moat around it and stock it with the alligators rather than figuring out how to close it. And it was really the change to, no, that's going away. We have to figure out how to keep it affordable, reliable, and make these changes. The other thing was, we've set up a bunch of different teams internally now to chase the innovation side of this. We won't do it alone as a company, but it's actually the embracing it as part of our culture. So we have people working on hydrogen. We have people rethinking a lot of the things that we're doing, trying to figure out how we get to 100. And I would say that our attitude is, it can be done. We don't exactly know all the technologies that will play to get there, but let's just put our efforts to figuring out how we do it. So that was really the change that came from the announcement that we drove through, and that's actually what we share with other companies when they talk to us about it. Quite frankly, we're happy if we can get them to embracing 80% carbon reduction, but getting them to embrace the 100% is actually embracing the innovation. And our belief, based on what we've seen in the wind and solar industry, is that as people actually set out to chase this, it can go faster, and that's good. But we also want to be exporting it to other other sectors, because transportation's overtaken us in carbon now.
How can we shift this timeline a bit and actually achieve these goals quicker than the 2030 mark and then the 2050 mark as well?
So I think one of the things we did with our December filing was to show, now that we've put the dates on exiting the plants, now we can actually talk about how we run the plants differently. We actually want to have those plants on a really cold day when we're going to need the energy for our customers, and a really hot day when we're going to need the energy for our customers. I don't necessarily want to be running my coal plants in the shoulder seasons. There's other resources available on the market. There's more renewables than that, particularly in the spring season, we get more wind energy. And so I want to be taking advantage of those and taking our energy at a time when customers use less and actually turning the coal plants off. The old method was you turn the coal plants down to a minimum run. So we're actually trying to figure out, in these shoulder seasons, can we turn our coal plants off? That also gives us an opportunity to see how the system performs without those units on and start solving those engineering questions. So that's really the how we can get better at it. The other thing that I think we can do is, this just looked at the electric sector. It's chasing the natural gas sector. It's chasing the transportation sector. And it's working with partners like District Energy, where we have arrangements and have opportunities to work together to think about how the two of us can embrace innovation. And, you know, District Energy and St. Paul Cogen have obviously spent a lot of time thinking about innovation. And so it's an opportunity for us as Minnesota companies to work together and do that. We're doing that with other companies here in Minnesota, too. 3M announced that they took their campus here in the Twin Cities to 100% renewable. We worked with them on that, and we're continuing to work with them and others on doing that. So that's a quick overview of some of the things we can do to keep going quickly.
Mm-hmm. And are you having people right now working on finding those engineering, I guess, like holes or questions that you still have?
Absolutely. There's a lot of work going on. We never want to sacrifice reliability. I think we all saw what happened in California because of where they were with the tree trimming and the fires. They actually had to turn systems off in order to try to prevent fires. That's not a happy place to be for the utility, and it's not a happy place to be for the customers. And so for us, that's just a reminder that we have to be constantly doing the work and figuring out how we make this. You know, a lot of customers take advantage of, they go to the wall and flip the switch and the lights come on. They don't have to think about what's behind it. We want to keep delivering that, but we want to do it while we're also delivering the results that we and our policymakers have identified as important. So I mentioned in July.
I thought maybe somebody else had a question, but no. All right,
okay.
Roll on.
In July, we did file with the commission the plan to hit 80% carbon reduction by 2030. These are the key elements of that. It is the closure of the coal plants. We're going to add significant renewables. We're in the middle of a big wind build-out now, taking advantage of the production tax credit. We're still seeing opportunity for wind, but we've hit some constraints now on the transmission system. So it's making adding more wind on top of what we're doing a little challenging right now. We'll continue to work with others in the industry to figure out how we can get more wind on the system, but it'll open up an opportunity to add a significant amount of solar. And I think we'll see bang for the buck by adding large-scale solar. We can do it most cost-effectively that way. But quite frankly, customers also like distributed solar. They like seeing it on homes and businesses. And so we'll try to work with the commission to figure the balance of that out. It's not nearly as cost-effective. So we tend to drive towards the larger projects because we can do them based on economies of scale. But you have to listen to the customers who want to see them on their local grocery store or their church or their houses. And so we'll try to work with the commission to get that balance right. We have asked to continue the life of our nuclear plant at Monticello. You asked for a 20-year license at the federal agency, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but we've said that we want to break that down into two 10-year increments so that the commission doesn't feel like in 2020 we're asking them to make a decision about what we do from 2040 to 2050. So that would take us out 10 years at Monticello. We need to make the decision on that plant now because its license ends in 2030, and you actually need to allow 8 to 10 years for the licensing process at the NRC. They move very carefully there, as you would expect, so we want to have the lead time. Prairie Island is 2033 and 34, so we have a little bit more time before we need to make that. That would likely get teed up in the next resource plan. One of the most important things to us in having the decision around Prairie Island is actually engaging with the Prairie Island Indian community, who is one of the closest, if not the closest, community both to a nuclear plant and to the spent fuel that's stored at a nuclear plant, because the federal government hasn't taken its obligation to move the fuel as seriously as we think they should have. So we've been engaged with the Prairie Island Indian community, and we'll continue to do that ahead of the next resource plan. We are also engaging nationally as a leader to try to get fuel moved. Yucca Mountain is quite controversial, so we are actually leading a coalition of utilities advocating for what's called consolidated interim storage, which would take the fuel stored at nuclear plants now and consolidate it in sites where communities agree to host it. Two communities that have stepped forward to do that, one is in Texas. They already have a low-level radioactive waste storage site, and that company is actually affiliated with the French company that moves fuel in France, so they actually know how to do this. The other company is another company that moves fuel internationally, and that's right across the border in New Mexico. It actually happens to be in our service territory there. We really do believe that moving the fuel is the right thing to do. It can be done safely, and it ought to be moved to a place where the communities embrace it, not next to communities who didn't sign up for that. So we're committed to doing that. It's a lot of work. It's very frustrating because we've been having this sort of no progress battle with the federal government for over 20 years. Consolidated interim storage actually gives us something real to chase. Other countries move fuel all the time. We actually move fuel all the time in the United States. It's just not talked about because it's the federal government doing it and the military doing it. So we know it can be done safely, and so we're committed to doing that. We've actually been working with the Prairie Island Indian community and the city of Red Wing and others in the Nuclear Waste Strategy Coalition to try to advance that agenda. So that's my little tangent into the complexities of the nuclear fuel side of or the used fuel or spent fuel that comes from the nuclear process. It is a carbon-free process. It really does help us accomplish a lot. The future of nuclear is also a fascinating sort of separate discussion. And I think the last thing I'll really say about that is if we're all serious about chasing the carbon, we're certainly in the camp of the coal needs to go before the nuclear goes. And we actually think there needs to be a conversation about whether nuclear fits in the long-range goals. It's not always a popular discussion, but sometimes being the leader, you actually have to say we need to have the hard conversations about this. And so that's one of the places where we're actually trying to engage in the conversation. The other part of the controversy of our plan has been that in closing the three units at Sherco in Becker, Minnesota, and the King Plant in Oak Park Heights, we believe we need a combined cycle gas unit to go into that place where we're closing the three coal units in Becker. The groups that have been pushing for no more coal and closure of coal have actually started turning a lot of their attention to making sure that the coal doesn't simply get replaced with natural gas. And so the no more fossil is really part of that movement now. And that means that every natural gas plant is controversial. Minnesota Power has seen this with their Nemadji Trail plant in Superior, Wisconsin. We're certainly seeing it with the proposal around Becker. Again, we want to engage in the conversation with stakeholders. We're certainly willing to look at alternatives. We just don't want to sacrifice reliability or affordability. And where we think we need the plant is not to run full out, which would still have about half the carbon of a coal plant, but actually it's a good resource to be able to integrate the renewables we're adding to our system and to be there in particular for times like the polar vortex. And to be honest and share with you, the polar vortex was not very pleasant to go outside and have to start your car to get to work or hop on the bus to go to work. And we actually spent a lot of time after that event looking at how our system operated, what we needed to make sure we kept furnaces running and the lights on. And then we also looked at some other times where we had low ability to import from our neighbors. Usually we can import a lot of energy from our neighbors, but if they're all using a lot, there's less available to import. And there are times when there's constraints on the transmission system. And then when we had a low solar resource and a low wind resource. And about the week after the polar vortex, the temperatures weren't bad by Minnesota standards. We were in the 0 to 10 degree range. So that's kind of normal winter in February in Minnesota. Put your coat on still, but we actually had low import capability in a few days without a very good solar resource, which we've all been through in Minnesota. And so that has actually made us go back and think, how much dispatchable resource or plants like a gas plant do we want to have? So that's part of the controversy that we're working through. I actually think if we proposed a plan and there were no controversy, I would wonder what's wrong. So that's part of the discussion we need to have, and that's what we do when we engage with the commission.
Ms. Prince has a question.
Sure.
And Mr. Clark, I really appreciate that you're here today and that you're so much emphasizing the ongoing innovation and research to avoid, to slow down and eliminate fossil as
right.
part of the whole outlook. This council did, and I'm sure you're aware,
right.
that we did pass a resolution in December stating pretty unequivocally that we would prefer not to see the creation of a gas fracking plant as we go forward to
sure.
2050. So I just wanted to state that so you're aware of it. But what I hear you saying is that you're looking at all other possibilities to to reduce the likelihood of multiple plants and...
We are, and one of the things we're doing is, you know, looking at a plant. When we build a plant like that, particularly one that starts in 2026, its life won't be 24 years. Those plants typically run 30 or 40 years, depending on how you choose to invest in it. We have a commitment at 2050 to be 100% carbon free. That means we need to be looking at how we would run that plant on hydrogen or other fuels. It also means we need to be looking at, could we do it with a smaller plant? Could we do it with something different than a natural gas plant? So all those things are things that we'll keep looking at. But we all are also guided by, we don't want to take any risk with reliability. And I actually appreciate the pressure on us that we need to move away as aggressively as we can from fossil. But we also want to make sure that we're not taking any risk with the system. So it's a little bit of our conservative nature on making sure that we can always keep the lights on and furnaces running against the innovation and ambition side. I would call it a healthy tension, and it's certainly fine for us to be pushed, and we certainly appreciate that you've been asked to weigh in and did. So part of our job.
I think it's a really interesting point, because you're talking about like the times when it's the very coldest and the very hottest, when people are most relying on the utility as the peak time. But also, I was just mentioning to Councilmember Naker that even just looking at wind, like it's windiest in the spring and the fall when you don't need peak.
Right.
Or even in a day, it's windiest at noon when you don't need peak. And
right.
So there is a tension there. And so I'm just translating that into my plain speak here, but I always think about those. It's like just when you need it the most is the time when the other options are most difficult to harness. So.
Right, and there are storage options out there and things being considered, and we're following that too. I think we're at the front end of batteries. I think they'll move faster than we're expecting. But batteries actually have a few issues of their own too. Right now they rely on, at times, rare earth resources and have disposal issues. Problems that can be solved, but problems to be solved. So challenges, I guess we like opportunities.
Thank you. I also appreciate your openness to the healthy tension. And I think what I heard folks saying during that controversy, there was concern about natural gas as a source for sure, but then there was also a separate and I think perhaps even greater concern about where that natural gas is coming from and
right.
fracking in particular as the source. So can you talk a little bit about, again, not being the technical experts here, but the alternatives to that particularly environmentally damaging way of getting the natural gas?
Yeah, so fracking has provided a revolution for us and has driven natural gas prices down, but it is... a newer, relatively newer method. The industry has been steadfast that they do it safely and that they do it with chemicals that can be recovered through the process. But we've also seen this before in our industry where you get a kind of a revolutionary way of doing things, and then as you move through the years, you see increasing regulation and increasing research and focus on what are the side impacts of that. I mean, even with wind, we've had avian studies and making sure that you're siting carefully based on proximity to neighbors, flicker, and noise. So every resource we use to generate has its consequences, and certainly there's a lot of debate around fracking. There are ways to get the natural gas without fracking, but you're still working with a fossil fuel. So for us, the opportunity is really, we think, where can you leapfrog this? And some of the leapfrog opportunities are the move to hydrogen, where we can generate the hydrogen in cleaner ways than hydrogen's being made now. Hydrogen you have to be careful with, obviously, but we think... again, it's a fuel that we know how to work with and move. So not a very detailed answer to your question, and we can provide maybe some more detailed information from people who are more expert at it than me, but that's maybe a quick attempt by me.
Mr. Tao.
Thank you, President. I was just curious, like, when we talk about wind turbine, I'm not an expert in that area, but I'm just curious, couldn't you change out the bearing so that you would get more rotation, so that you would then produce more electricity?
What we've seen from the wind industry is actually a very aggressive embracing of innovation and technology in the production of wind. So wind farms that previously would have generated about a 30% capacity factor, so we were getting energy from them about 30, 36% of the time, through improvements in the blade technology, improvements in the nacelle, which includes the gears and working parts that you're talking about, the height of the turbine, the length of the blades, better sighting through modeling. All those things have contributed to being able to get higher capacity factors out of wind farms. So a lot of the wind farms we're installing now, we're in the 45 to 55% capacity factor range. So the industry, the wind industry, has done a good job of chasing just those kinds of technology improvements that you're talking about. And they're actually continuing to chase those because the production tax credit will get 100% value of that tax credit by 2020, and then it steps down to 80, then it steps down to 60 and 40, and then fades away. And what the industry is trying to do is make sure they can keep their prices competitive even as that tax credit steps down. They're having success with it, but it will continue to take a lot of R&D work on them to see how they can get more and more energy out of them. And they're actually doing it, so that's been an exciting part of that. And it's part of why it's really helped us embrace the innovation, because in the late 90s, we would not have seen the energy that we can get from a wind farm. And what we're getting today and the price we're getting, which is actually cheaper than our coal units with the production tax credit, is absolutely amazing. So, and we're seeing similar things in solar where the technology is driving costs down and energy output up, even without having to move the panels. But then there are systems that will move and follow the sun and you get more resource too. So very much what the industry is focused on and what the supply chain's delivering for us.
Sure. As a quick follow-up, is it like a standard that, for example, the wind turbine, that they need to produce minimum like 40, 45, 50% capacity?
There isn't necessarily that, but what tends to happen is, in order for it to be competitive and economic, as these vendors compete with each other to deliver the resource, they're all driving to the bigger turbines and they're driving to those higher capacity factors. So in the recent RFP that we did, we were seeing very consistently those high capacity factor outputs from the wind farms. We're also seeing some of the older farms where we had the lower capacity factors that the vendors and suppliers are going back through and identifying where they can change out older equipment and deliver the higher capacity factor.
Sure. And then from a profit standpoint, you think that there are energy companies that know that they can produce more energy, but they don't, so that they can create scarcity to increase the profit?
You know, after California went through what it did, I want to say it was kind of at the same time that Enron collapsed, so 12 years ago. Not sure I have my dates exactly right, where there were entities withholding resources from the market, the federal government has actually put in place a lot of rules and penalties for doing that, so that people who withhold from the market are actually penalized pretty severely. The fines are significant enough that I think those actors have been driven out of the market. And for instance, our market desk and our operators are very careful to make sure that everything we're doing is complying with the market monitor. And just as an example of that, I said in December we filed to operate our coal plants differently. One of the reasons we're doing that filing is actually to be transparent with those regulators that we want to turn our units off. We don't want to turn them off to drive market prices up. We want to turn them off to reduce carbon, but we want to be transparent with the market regulators what we're doing on that front.
And so far, you guys aren't on that list of the.
We do not operate our system in a way that would ever put us even close to that line. So, yeah. So that's our resource plan that we filed in July. It will get us a significant amount of change to our resource mix. These are actually big changes to a big machine that we're actually, again, trying to lead the way for others to figure out how they can let go of their coal units. We think there's more potential on the wind and solar side there, so those numbers will simply just push against the natural gas side of that. The other renewables tends to be small hydro on our Wisconsin system. And then we have some imports that we do from Manitoba Hydro. If they can keep their prices competitive, we'll keep using them too. We also want to reduce people's energy efficiency, and we've committed to this in the resource plan, a significant amount of electricity usage reduction, and likewise with natural gas. One of the things we'll see is as more technology comes into our system, particularly as the meter on your house becomes more like a computer that's talking to other appliances in your house, there will be opportunities to really rethink how we use energy. One of our commissioners at the Minnesota Commission is really intrigued by the opportunities to do what he calls demand response. We can already do this with air conditioners, but if we can start doing it even more, doing it with when people charge cars so that we're driving that charging to a time when we have renewable energy available and not being used for other purposes, we can really continue to use the energy very efficiently. And we want that technology to be things that people don't even have to think about. You go home, you plug your car in, the charger's already working with our system to know when to charge. You don't have to think about it. You can override it if you have a need to charge faster with the push of a button or a click on your phone.
Ms. Anker?
Thank you. Not a question, but we sometimes just go through huge points, and I just want to point out I think that's startling and really significant, the 13 additional power plants that did not have to be built because of energy savings. I mean, that's huge. So it's really helpful when you put it in that kind of context to see what efficiency can result in.
It is, and those would tend to be those peaking plants that are out there that would run on natural gas. They're basically a jet engine that you strap to the ground and you run them on those hot summer days. We're running a lot less of those because of efficiency. Our customers love it. I do have to say the LED lighting change, you take like the Mall of America, or not the Mall of America, the airport ramps, when they put those lights in on those ramps, it's about an 80% energy usage reduction. And the lighting is actually better. You have to be careful with the colors on LEDs, but way better than the shift that we had when we went through compact fluorescence. So, yeah, it's a fun business when you see things like that rolling through.
Ms. Jalali.
And I think this is like a success story example that we'd want to keep scaling up with you. Our climate action plan talks about roughly half of the emissions in our city that we're trying to bring down are through buildings and through energy efficiency.
Right.
We just passed our benchmarking ordinance, which is for our biggest buildings in the city to be able to start tracking their energy usage and be able to find ways to be more efficient. I'm sure you know this. It's all the sort of weird hidden things like random equipment on at night. The light bulb example. We've heard of things where someone had like a swimming pool that was uncovered and there's just like energy leaking out of
right.
it. And then you find like the energy and financial cost of that, and it's just like millions of units and dollars. So we'd love to keep working with you on this toward energy efficiency and for making the linkage between housing affordability and energy efficiency,
right.
our older building stock that is leakier and doesn't hold in heat and energy well. And, that's money out of the pockets of already very vulnerable renters and families.
Absolutely.
That energy bill, utility bill becoming a smaller portion of their pie. Your programs help so much with that, and we're trying to figure out on the building stock side how to balance that equation even better and support kind of the twin goals of affordability and energy efficiency. And we'd love to keep just innovating on how to do this better with you, given the incentives you can get from the state sometimes and other sources we have. So I just think it's like, to Councilman Naker's point, it's a big point also in that it's like such a huge portion of the work we're trying to do as a city.
Right.
And it's just a very key area I think we would love to keep working.
Well, you're absolutely right, particularly when you get to rental units and you want to, it can be hard to get the incentives aligned there. So it's important work to do. And I think the state has done in Minnesota a tremendous amount of work on this and is focusing on buildings as part of that discussion. I know Commissioner Kelly was speaking the other day at an event that I was attending about bringing some additional legislation forward in this session. There's also changes to the conservation programs that are likely to come forward as legislation this session. We're working with a lot of the providers who are contractors for us on opportunities there. There's a lot to keep chasing. We do think as we add technology to the system that there'll be whole new fields of data that makes finding some of those things easier. Even things like, you know, we've had the anecdote of a dentist office where the person comes in to get everything ready and they turn all the equipment on at the same time, and that creates a big demand spike. Whereas if they simply stagger that over 15-minute periods, it changes the profile dramatically. And, you know, little things like that, but they both impact the bill and they impact what our system has to deliver at one point. So we'll keep working on that and look forward to the partnership. These are just some of the things that we make sure that we consider when we're doing this. Safety is obviously something we never want to sacrifice. Affordability. Affordability actually gives us an opportunity to talk about how we're making this transition and thinking about equity. There are different places where we have that opportunity. One is in our workforce where we're experiencing a big changeover, so we actually have a chance to diversify our workforce to look more like and be more like the communities we serve. But to your point, we also have opportunities to think about those for whom energy is a bigger portion of their bill and how we can create opportunities there. And then a final example I'll give is with transportation, making sure that we're not just chasing expensive cars for people who can afford a Tesla or a car of that cost, but that we're working with things like car sharing programs and actually buses and school buses, which are in our more populated areas and communities that have often been the last to receive the benefits. Can we deliver electric buses and electric school buses to those communities at the front end of this transition?
Ms. Anker.
Thank you. To the point about diversifying the workforce and also the point you made earlier about the moat with the alligators in it to protect the last plant, I'm just wondering how...
Engineers don't like that joke, by the way, but I keep telling it because
everything stays in this room. Just okay. Kidding. It doesn't at all. I'm just wondering, how transferable are those skills from when you close a coal plant and you're talking about moving towards nuclear, hydrogen, renewables? Is there workforce development and workforce retraining that you're thinking about, too, and that's possible so that that's not resulting in another kind of disruption on the human side?
So for every coal plant we have closed, we've been able to use lead time, attrition, retirements, and transfers that are available to our union members in the workforce so that we have not had a layoff, and we don't anticipate having layoffs as part of our closures. Mm-hmm. One of the benefits of bringing plants down and knowing when they're not running is we can do cross-training. So people who are working at a coal plant can work at a gas plant, can work on the distribution or transmission system. Our nuclear fleet uses a lot of contractors during outages. One of the conversations we're having with the unions is we have three reactors. The outages are staggered. Can we actually create within our workforce more jobs so that we're actually creating opportunity there and then have a group that's willing to move around to the different reactors for those outages? So from the very simple, are we going to have to lay people off from closing coal plants? We don't believe so. The other thing we're trying to take into account is we had 350 workers or so at the Sherco plants. As we go down to a gas plant, if we build the gas plant there, you're running a gas plant with 25 workers or so. Or less. So you're not going to replace the 350 jobs. So when we announced the 1- and 2-unit closure at Sherco, we committed to the economic development. We have a lot of land around that site. So we were able to work to move Northern Metals up there. Northern Metals obviously was having a lot of challenges with PCA and was in a location where I think the city of Minneapolis was ready for something else to be on that site. They now will have a state-of-the-art indoor shredder, be one of the cleanest shredding operations in the world, and they'll bring jobs to the area to help replace what's going away. We're working to attract Google with the same theory of let's create jobs. Data centers aren't huge employers, but constructing them is a huge employer, and we're looking for other opportunities to do that as well. And energy efficiency is a place where We use a lot of contractors, but it's actually a good entry job into the energy sector. People tend to think about green jobs. I consider energy efficiency green jobs, and that's a place where people can get in the entry and then kind of move into other jobs in the energy industry.
That's great. Thanks.
So we do try to keep that commitment to host communities. Obviously, you're a host community. I saw our power plant down the river here is running today, and we like to work with our host communities. There is a tax piece that goes with that, and so as we close plants, we'll have to work with these communities to work on the impact from that change. It's been a very good benefit for those communities, but it's a very significant change. And there's actually a whole exciting utility property tax discussion that swirls around occasionally at the legislature. But I'm not going to go into that because you won't invite me back if I do. But you all know how important the tax and revenue discussion is. I've talked a lot about embracing energy and innovation. Lots of opportunity here. Again, something that we're working on with St. Paul Cogen and District Energy, I hope, as we go forward. So excited about actually having some innovation to showcase here in St. Paul. And I think that's just one of the many examples we'll have here in St. Paul to showcase what we're doing. The Ford site, another opportunity as well. We do have our low-income programs. I'd just like to provide a few numbers on these. This is an area that we work with groups like Pam Marshall's Energy Sense Coalition. We work with other stakeholders around this. There's always more that we can do on this field, but it is a conversation that we're having, particularly when we have rate discussions with the commission.
Ms. Brown.
Yeah, and on this point, it's my understanding that it's been hard for low-income renters to get the benefits of your low-income programs. And I'm wondering about Xcel's position on inclusive financing, because it's something that really makes a lot of sense to me. And,
sure.
And we'd love to see some progress in that area.
Yeah, we've actually been having quite a bit of discussion, both us and CenterPoint Energy, around different financing options. We've also had some conversation with the energy efficiency providers that are vendors for us. We look at some other areas of the country that have done this with kind of mixed success, and I think we're open to exploring those solutions. We want to make sure that they're actually delivering something workable without a lot of bureaucracy to it. And I would put that in the category of something we're working on, but I think CenterPoint is working to advance a pilot, and we're certainly engaged in that conversation and happy to keep engaging in it. We also provide a lot of jobs. People think of us as a cost, particularly in the business community. What can you do to lower our bill? This is a conversation I frequently have with our big users. I just like to remind them that a lot of times we are actually buying products from them, and we're actually contributing to the economy here in Minnesota. The stuff we build is capital intensive. We have skilled workers who come in and use materials made by other companies. And so just an opportunity to remind them. We do spend a lot of money with diverse suppliers and also with local providers here in Minnesota. And we have a group that's actually focused on working to increase those numbers. And then we are the state's biggest taxpayer on property taxes. I'm happy to share that with my customers too, but it's the vehicle we use in Minnesota, and so I just like to point out to people that that is there.
And you pay property taxes not only to the cities, but also the state?
Correct. We have a central assessment method that's typical for states to assess utilities. So that's centrally assessed and then distributed out to the local, basically to the local, back to communities, the local taxing authorities. And that's why the places with power plants get a big chunk of that. But also any place where we have a line or a transmission line, you're going to see some of that benefit flowing back. We also, this is actually in the personal property tax category that many other businesses are exempted from. So I'll also have that conversation with the business community of remember that you're exempted from this. Effectively, you're paying some of it in our utility bill through the form of what we pay in property taxes. It's just kind of a helpful to remind people where the revenue is coming into the system.
Ms. Anker.
Thank you. I know you said you didn't really want to talk about this too much, but the property tax proposal at the legislature, just high level, does that increase or decrease that number?
The original proposal was one to switch from a plant-based central assessed value of assets system to more of a production, which plants were actually producing. It's the system that we use for wind energy, for instance. It's based on energy produced. That proposal has sort of fallen out of favor now that we're talking about closing plants, because obviously those communities will see less benefit. Now the conversation is more around, as we pull big assets off the system and move to a different set of assets, what sort of transition needs to happen for communities who are seeing assets closed? And then what sort of conversation do we need to be having with Department of Revenue and the local authorities around what does their revenue picture look like in the future? So as an example, Red Wing and Goodhue County were a big chunk of supporting that community because of the presence of the two units at Prairie Island Nuclear Plant. If that plant closes in 33, 34, they actually want to be planning for that now. So that's what a lot of the conversation has moved to. The other piece, and Commissioner Bowerly and I have joked about this quite a bit, that happens is the discussion around if the gas tax produces less revenue because we're successful in moving people to electric vehicles and other forms of transit, how does that revenue get made up? And I've told her, don't worry, don't put it on the bill. Just go find some other method, like the devices you put in the cars that provide the per mileage based fees. And they remind me that's not popular with Minnesotans. So these are complex issues in making sure that the revenue that is needed for the system comes in. And so it's just basically engaging in the discussion. I think on the front end, because we have time, but when you're talking about big revenue changes, you obviously have people get passionate about wanting to make sure they can continue to provide the services they're providing. And that's really what the discussion is. I would say 2 or 3 years ago, there was a proposal that was moving and had some chance of getting passed. I would say now we're more in the dialogue and gathering facts rather than actually having a proposal that's likely to get through in this session or even the next couple of sessions.
And so just to follow up, not necessarily something that would affect a community like St. Paul where you're not talking about plant closures.
Correct. Correct. And I think for St. Paul, I mean, obviously High Bridge is a big contributor, but our core metro cities tend to be a little bit more neutral in this than the greater Minnesota communities where that plant had such a presence in the tax base.
But it's interesting because it sounds like a light version of fiscal disparities where you're trying to certainly wouldn't want to prevent you from doing a closure or for doing the work that is in the best interest of the climate, the community, the state, because there's a lot of passion around closing a plant or losing that revenue. And so how do we try to make sure that those impacts are incenting appropriate long-term decisions?
Correct. And the other place it comes up is in the bonding discussions. And I know St. Paul has obviously things that are important for St. Paul and the bonding. Becker, for example, has money that they're seeking as part of that redevelopment of land that was basically just buffer land around the plant. You know, now they're looking at, can that be developed to provide some of those jobs? So it comes in the bonding bill too.
Interesting.
We also like to volunteer in our communities. We have a day of service. I know a lot of corporations around the communities do this, and the Twin Cities is obviously has very generous residents and citizens and workforce, and we're proud of what we do on that. We do like to say we work here and we live here, so we are invested in our communities. We can't move our production out of state, and we don't want to. We want to continue to be here. We see lots of opportunities to work with our communities as we move forward.
Ms. Prince.
Mr. Clark, there, and I don't see it, I'm not sure if it's included here in this community collaboration, but something that's been really important on the east side, and I suspect in the rest of the city, is the idea of cooperative, community cooperative solar gardens.
Sure.
And I believe Xcel was lined up to help us with the one on Railroad Island.
Correct.
And that fell through, and the interest is not abating. So I'm wondering if we can have some discussions going forward about how to get some of that work off the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. We are actually still working to see what we can put together at Railroad Island. You're right, the project that it was initially proposed has kind of fallen apart. We're still at the table working on that one with Pam Marshall from Energy Sense and others to try to figure out what we can do there that would be a combination of a demonstration solar, maybe more akin to what we have at Highbridge, fairly small, but also some energy efficiency and trying to figure out how to get buy-in from the residents and actually, you know, being willing to put in the energy efficiency measures and embrace that, and then also some opportunities to see what sort of training and workforce opportunities there could be. So a lot of ideas on the table, trying to drive it to reality is hard. And then on the community solar garden, we've had a lot of frustration, to be honest, with the community solar garden program. What we've seen is a program that was, in our view, initially designed to be very community-focused, actually became a program focused on more in development in the exurbs, where there's you can put a 5-megawatt installation, 5 1-megawatt installations together. It's expensive power for us to buy. It does have the community positive to it, but it's also become a place for subsidy to flow to corporations mm-hmm. who own a big chunk of that. Mm-hmm. And then the ownership, which we view was originally let local community members participate in the building and ownership. A lot of those projects have actually been bought up by big utility holding companies that are based out of state. So we think there's a lot of room to improve community solar gardens going forward. I actually really like the model because, like I said, a lot of residents want to see it in the stores they go to, in the neighborhoods they in their churches and what in their schools. And so I think there's opportunity. We're engaging with the solar community. We've also had interest in both the House Democrats and Senate Republicans on where we can take the program to maybe get to a better place. So I think it's something we need to keep working on. It doesn't have the economics of the big utility scale, mm-hmm. But it has the benefits of the community participation in something. And so I think it's something we need to keep working on.
You know, I think that's huge because the subject of climate change is something where I definitely see it in my community is people are trying to figure out how to access it.
Right.
I think that involving people in a community solar project makes it personal. And also when you talk about the examples of how people could be, you know, the dentist's office example, which is such a good one. I think once we can make it something that people can see and touch and feel, I think their ability to, you know, think about their own role and their own use of the system becomes that much more important and acute to them. So I hope we can continue that conversation because it has been ongoing in my community since I was elected in 2015.
Okay. That's actually really good feedback for me to hear because I share that back with my colleagues. And I mean, we are committed to that conversation. It happens every year at the legislature. And
it is in my neighborhood, it's very grassroots. And I think your point about the purchase to the large private corporations is something that will not be something that they would be supportive of.
Right.
So so that's great. I hope we can continue that
conversation.
Yeah, and
I think that sometimes it takes that grassroots push to know this is what we really want, and we figure out how to work together to deliver it.
You know, sometimes, I mean, in terms of a gas fracking, when, you know, when you talk about the importance to Xcel of the reliability of the system, and when you talk to people at the neighborhood level, the reliability of the system is going to be deeply impacted if flooding continues,
yes,
if wildfire continues.
Yeah.
If, and so I think people at the grassroots level are very much wanting to make the sacrifices at the grassroots level that are going to be critical so that our grandchildren can have a world that we can live in. And I know I'm not telling you anything that you don't know, but I think that's been the value of the CARP that we just passed, is that, you know, we're really speaking to people at the house-to-house, neighborhood-to-neighborhood level, where real change can occur.
Yeah.
So
that's,
thanks for your openness to that.
Yeah, it's a lot of challenge, but a lot of opportunity here. And I think the part that keeps it exciting and keeps it hopeful is the opportunity around innovation and what we can do if we are successful with that. So
right.
Thank you for the feedback.
Mm-hmm.
I do see a lot of opportunity coming for collaboration. I think the Rethinking Transit is a great opportunity, and so we'll look forward to working with communities, with you all on that as we go forward. We put a few numbers here together just to give you a sense of where some of the money is flowing into the St. Paul community. And then a couple of final things I like to emphasize. I talked about the workforce. We are a big employer in the state, in the Twin Cities, in St. Paul. We've been a really successful place to attract veterans to work. The service that people have in the military and the kind of jobs that they have lend themselves well to the kind of work that we do. So we've had success there, from the nuclear Navy to people who like being outside and working with their hands, willing to climb a pole in a storm. Those are things that don't come naturally to everyone like me. So those have been a good fit. The diversity hiring, we're making improvements. We've actually had some really good progress over the last couple of years, but we have a lot of work to do here still, and we're committed to doing that. We also like to work with nonprofits in our community because they really help us stay in touch with that grassroots feedback of what's going on in our communities. Our employees more and more like to volunteer as much or more than they like to give. We actually are working to make sure that we can get both out of them, and we've seen this change across the community. I think the United Way has been sort of a place where we've really seen a lot of that change in how people volunteer and give. And so this is something we pay attention to, but also something that's very fulfilling for us and our employees. And we just put together, you'll have the slides, just some of the different nonprofits that we work with here in the communities. My team who's here with me, Elisa, John, Jim, all connected with these groups, and we work to have people both volunteer, serve on boards, and be helpful, and we really try to make that part of our corporate culture and our commitment to the community, so that it's not just something we do with funding or working on a project, but actually taking time away from work to go participate.
Ms. Prince.
And to that point, and although it was definitely part of Jim's job, I want to thank Jim for the number of hours he spent meeting with the St. Paul 350 people about the IRP.
Yeah.
And so that was, I think, brought the conversation with our communities. It really advanced it and built trust that's going to be important going forward.
Well, like I said, I recognize there's some controversy around what we're doing. Leading is not easy, but we want to be a leader, and part of making sure that we're doing our job is that we're listening to people even when they don't disagree with us, and trying to find solutions that work for all of us. We'll hold our ground when we think we're right, but we'll do so in a manner that is explaining what we're doing and trying to be willing to listen and always be open to new ideas too. So thank you very much for the opportunity to spend a lot of time with you here this morning. I really appreciate it. I get really excited about what we're doing at the company. I love telling the story. I love having an audience who's engaged like you. Actually, not an audience. You're actually participating in this with us as policy leaders. So, again, thank you for everything you do, and we look forward to working with you as we go forward.
Great. Thank you so much. And as you can tell, as Anne pointed out, this group is engaged. They're interested in what you had to say today and really committed to continuing to partner with you as we move forward through the challenges and opportunities in front of us. There may be some follow-up that will come to you by way of...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But in the meantime, thank you so very much for being here.
Sure. Yeah, thanks.
All right. That is the end of our agenda for today. So until later this afternoon, we are adjourned.